In 1980, the great economist Milton Friedman published Free to Choose. In it, he extolled the virtues of free market capitalism, its ability to lift hardworking families out of poverty, modernize entire economies, and raise the standard of living for everyone. The United States, he and his wife explained, was among the finest examples of what's possible when a government simply takes its hand off the wheel. His utopia, however, was not the US, but rather somewhere halfway across the globe, Hong Kong. Quote, the modern exemplar of free markets and limited government. So enamored was he with its faithful application of capitalism that Friedman devoted many of his remaining years delivering talks, writing articles, and traveling the world telling its story.
If you want to see how the free market really works, this is the place to come.
It was such a textbook rags-to-riches example, in part thanks to its physical transformation. This is Victoria Harbor around 1890, a barren coastline the British government was once indifferent to. Here it is in the early 1960s. And finally, this is Hong Kong in all its vertical glory at the end of the 20th century. Today, with 70% more skyscrapers than New York, it just exudes abundance. Its GDP per capita, already formidable on its own, becomes nothing short of miraculous when compared to its once colonial master. And while the US is more closely associated with capitalism thanks to its size, in some ways it more closely resembles Finland, Sweden, or Denmark than Hong Kong. According to the Fraser Institute and Heritage Foundation, there's no place on earth with more private ownership, lower public expenditure, simpler tax law, or less regulation. Its leader is even called the chief executive, the very first of which was, quite fittingly, Tong Kien Hwa, the billionaire CEO of a shipping company. But what appears to be an almost religious adherence to capitalism may have been, in fact, more historical happenstance. The great economist may have been wrong all along. Sponsored by CuriosityStream and Nebula, where you can watch the bonus video which accompanies this one for just $15 a year. During the British Empire, colonial bureaucrats were not sent directly from London, as you might expect, but rather hopped between crown colonies. Sir Dennis Roberts, for example, began his career in the army before being posted to Nyasaland, a British protectorate in Africa, followed by Gibraltar, and then as the Chief Justice of Hong Kong. Because of this, by the time the sun finally set on the empire with Hong Kong as the last major holdout, there had developed a great difference in style and philosophy between London and its distant colonies. Milton Friedman called this an economic experiment. Britain and Hong Kong, although both British in name, pursued two very different economic systems, one hands-on and the other off. The reason, in the free market narrative, was a man named Sir John James Copperthwaite. Copperthwaite was the financial secretary during the 60s. He believed government intervention did more harm than good, and in any case was too hard to predict. He accidentally became a kind of capitalist hero after Friedman met him during a brief stopover. When asked about the local economy, Copperthwaite replied that he honestly didn't know the answer. He was philosophically opposed to keeping any records, as it might give the government grounds to interfere. His successor gave this do-nothing approach an academic-sounding name, positive non-interventionism, and the rest is history. The true story, however, is quite different. The first reason Hong Kong was so financially prudent was that it had to be. Britain expected that, quote, the local revenue will be adequate to defray all the expenses of the government of Hong Kong. London even made the city pay for most of the British garrison, a giant, intimidating 30-story military base in the middle of the city's financial district. Second, with financial independence came administrative independence. The British elite in Hong Kong had no desire to cede control to London, who would surely attach conditions to further funding. By spending so little, the colony remained self-sufficient, and the rich could enjoy their autonomy without needing to beg the queen for help. They also worried generous social welfare would attract too many migrants from up north. And so, between 1948 and 97, Hong Kong ran a deficit for just 7 of 50 years. Finally, and most disturbingly, free market ideology both distracted from Britain's failures and justified its ethnic discrimination. Contrary to what many believe, Hong Kong was never democratic. Bureaucrats were appointed from 5,000 miles away, and never by popular vote. The supposed meritocracy of the invisible hand of the free market was a convenient scapegoat. It also provided the colonial government with some source of legitimacy. It was supposed to be above politics, composed merely of neutral technicians allowing citizens to prosper. In reality, zoning laws, elite schools, and favoritism all gave the 1% British population an unfair advantage. As you can see, capitalist policies were driven less by ideology and more by historical circumstances. And while its lack of natural resources is often cited as further evidence of its miraculous transformation, this argument relies on a very narrow definition of natural resources. Is strategically located geography like that of Hong Kong or Singapore not the best and least corruptible of resources? But regardless of why it adopted the policies that it did, the Hong Kong of today is either not an accurate example of capitalism in practice, or a striking example of its perils. The list of monopolies is long. At its one and only container port, the world's eighth largest, just two companies, Hutchinson and Modern, together control 21 of 24 berths, 87%. The privately owned Jockey Club is granted a total monopoly on gambling, which, in exchange, sprays charity around the city at a rate only guilt could explain. The government carefully regulates both the number of public buses and bus companies, resulting in only two major players, KMB and New World First Bus. There are just two electric companies, China Light and Power and Hong Kong Electric, which serve different areas. In a city of nearly 8 million, every last pound of fresh beef comes from one private company, Mfeng Hong, who has a complete monopoly on the license to import cattle. Likewise, consumers have only one source of gas. But all this pales in comparison to the hidden retail duopoly. Just two conglomerates, through a tangled mess of subsidiaries, own so many retail stores that it would be nearly impossible for someone living in Hong Kong not to patronize at least one. On one side is Jardine Matheson, which owns Dairy Farm International, which owns every local Manning's, IKEA, Welcome, Pizza Hut, Marketplace by Jason's, Starbucks, KFC, Maxim's, and the city's 900 7-Elevens. On the other side is CK Hutchinson Holdings, founded by Hong Kong's richest man, Lee Ka-shing. Hutchinson owns A.S. Watson Group, who owns Three, Fusion, Watson's, Park & Shop, Taste, and Fortress. Watson's and Manning's control nearly the entire personal care market, while Park & Shop and Welcome are the two largest grocery stores. It should be no surprise, then, that groceries are more expensive in Hong Kong than Tokyo, Singapore, or the UK. And then there are the hidden taxes. While Hong Kong has no capital gains, sales, withholding, or value-added tax, it charges a very high stamp duty on homes. Locals pay a standard 15% tax on homes after their first. Non-permanent residents pay 30%, effectively preventing any foreigner from ever buying a home. But at least the government gets out of the way, letting the free market run its course, right? How else could it be ranked the most economically free place on earth for decades? To answer this question, one need only look to the food truck pilot scheme. In 2015, the Hong Kong government decided food trucks, at this point already popular in cities around the world, might attract tourists. After 9 months of study and 1 year of preparation, a pilot scheme was launched. Only 8 trucks would be allowed for a city of 8 million. Then there were the rules. Kitchens needed to be at least 65 square feet, trucks required a 32-gallon water tank, and the sink had to be 1.5 feet long, to name just a few. To meet these requirements, restaurant owners had to invest in entirely new and costly vehicles. Changing any part of the menu required approval from the government, and no tables, chairs, or tents were allowed. But they did make an app. It conveniently shows the location of each food truck. Oh, except they aren't allowed to move. The trucks must stay in the same location and pay no less than 15% of gross revenue on parking. Ironically, food trucks are perhaps the best illustration of free market capitalism. The bad quickly fail while the good remain. Chefs are free to experiment with new dishes with low risk, and there are few barriers to entry. A perfect competitive environment that benefits the consumer. So, why so much regulation? What explains Hong Kong's laissez-faire attitude when it comes to groceries, utilities, and buses, and yet its micromanaging of food trucks? In reality, its bias is not in the direction of free markets or non-intervention in general, but in maintaining the status quo, one that benefits the largest corporations. Hong Kong appears to be a free market paradise because it allows large corporations free rein, until only those large corporations remain. But wherever there are small businesses, food trucks for example, it suddenly doesn't seem so ideologically strict. The only pattern to its behavior is pro-business. One third of employees work more than 48 hours a week, making it the most overworked city on earth. It has a low minimum wage, and some CEOs were even allowed to bypass its COVID travel quarantine, one of the strictest in the world. A more accurate word might be corporatocracy, rule by corporation. And there's a very good reason for this. In any country, corporations are afforded some of the same rights as we are, the ability to sign contracts and sue others in court, for example. Some countries even describe corporations as legal people, but in Hong Kong, corporations actually vote. That's not hyperbole for political influence. No, corporations legally cast ballots. The Hong Kong election system is deliberately complicated and difficult to understand, which is why I explain how corporations vote in Hong Kong in a separate, unaffected by the YouTube algorithm video on Nebula. Almost every other Polymatter video has bonus or extended content available on Nebula, as do many of your favorite channels, including entire Nebula-exclusive originals like Sam from Wendover's documentary on Alaska, Tom Scott's game show, or Tirzu's Let's Play Outside. For just 15 bucks a year, not a month, but a year, you also get access to Curiosity Stream, home to great documentaries like this one, exploring Hong Kong as a traveler, or this one about how the tallest building in the world works. Sign up with the link in the description and watch the bonus video about Hong Kong's election system over on Nebula.